the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 501, from Monday, May 12th, 2014.
And welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, tips, and cool stuff found. We answer your tips. We share your questions. We all like cool stuff found. And together, we all try to learn at least something new each and every time we come together. Today, we'll set that bar at three things new for you. This episode is sponsored in part by Gazelle at gazelle.com, where you can sell off all your old Apple stuff for cash real fast. And also by the folks at Drobo at drobo.com, makers of the fine Drobo 5D direct connected attached storage and the 5N network attached storage. And we'll tell you more about both of those later in the episode here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Congratulations on making it through 500 episodes together, man. That was fun.
I don't know how we pulled it off.
I know. It's awesome. Thanks to everybody out there for the last 500 episodes, and thanks to our great panel that we had in episode 500. It was good. All that said, John, I'm really have been excited for the last 4 or 5 days about this episode, because it's we get to just do what we do, which I like too. So it's all good. That's all good. Anything to report, John, before we dive into?
Yes.
Go.
I told you I had to report something here just because it's something that people have been asking for, Dave.
Well, then by all means.
Well, many people have been lamenting, I believe that's the right word, they miss having colored labels in the Finder.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Boy, wouldn't it be great if somebody wrote a utility that actually got around this problem and gave them back to you?
Sure. Yeah.
Well,
because we all know change is bad and we need things back the way they used to be.
Well, the good news is, so I just got an update to a utility that I like using, Total Finder, and they just released Total Finder version 1.6. And guess what? Total Finder 1.6 has colored labels now.
Oh, very nice.
So, yes, you do have to pay for this. I believe it's $16 for a single user license. There's a number of ways you can not pay for a license. I think my in was being a member of the media, though. I think I actually did. I paid for it anyways, just because it's.
Yeah, I like to do that.
Does so many things. They've added some of the features to the Finder, but yeah, he just released this days ago. And when I saw the note in the release notes saying colored labels, I'm like, oh, awesome.
That's awesome. Oh, very cool.
So things are much more obvious now and much more, in my opinion, if you've made use of colored labels, much more usable in the Finder now. So if you haven't checked out Total Finder, check it. And there's a link here to his blog entry talking about it. So and hats off, man, to figure that out. I think he had to jump through a few hoops to make that happen.
That's great. Yeah, man. Oh, good stuff. Good stuff. I know a lot of people are going to be happy about that. So, John, we'll put a link to that in the show notes so you can go check it out. We've talked at times about the Tor network, TOR, the Onion Router network, which is a way of anonymizing your internet traffic. And in a nutshell, for those of you that don't remember the discussion or weren't here for it, what Tor allows you to do is, or the way it works is, you connect to your computer connects to one computer. And then that computer connects to another, and then at least one more, potentially more than that, before your connection then goes out to wherever it is you want to go to. And what happens there, because you're connecting through at least three computers, you are separated by enough from the destination that the destination, that nobody even in the middle knows who you are, let alone the person at the end. So it's a very convenient way of routing your traffic automatically and anonymously. And on the Mac, there has been this Tor browser bundle that is the easiest, though not the most secure way. You have to be careful. You have to use it in the right way. If you start doing things like, say, entering your personal information, then the people on the other end are going to know who you are. But there's also things like JavaScript that can kind of sometimes betray you and identify your IP address and things like that. So you've got to use things properly, but if you use the Tor browser bundle properly, you're fine. And there's
awesome. Well, there must be an iOS version of that, Dave.
Well, there isn't, right?
I was disappointed in that as well. I'm like, oh, well, let me go to the website for Tor browser bundle. And I'm like, where's the iOS version?
Right.
No.
Yeah, exactly. And there have been, and there are, we've checked out a bunch of different Tor browsers for iOS. And the best one that we found really wasn't that great. It was called Onion Browser. And it didn't allow tabs and it was really flaky. And if you rotated your screen, it would do funny stuff. But it did work in that it connected you to the Tor network. And most importantly, it didn't do any funny stuff like some other browsers some other Tor browsers that had come out. I suppose people that released these things figured, well, people might use these for nefarious purposes. So maybe they won't complain if we put some spyware or something in there and make them into, you know, pieces of malware. So it's because of that, John, that we...
There was one that did that, I believe. And yeah, that made people nervous and that it somehow slipped through the App Store approval process. How could that possibly happen?
Well, how are they going to know, right? I mean, the traffic's going through the Tor network. So, you know, who knows, right? So when this new browser from Omar, I believe it's Omar Modi, it might be Omar Moody. Let me get that right. It is Omar Modi, I think. At gplexdb.com, but we'll put links in the show notes, released not that long ago and has been releasing updates since a piece of software called Red Onion. And it sort of answers all of those issues with Onion Browser. And it's 99 cents on the App Store. So it's really not that expensive. And I downloaded it and tested it, but it did clearly connect to the Tor network. It certainly appeared to from inside the browser. But John, I went to you and I said, hey, I know you're Mr. Wireshark. So before we go tell our listeners about this, will you just run this on your network and look at the traffic with Wireshark and let me know if you see anything funny or if it just looks like it's connecting to Tor and all as it should be. And I talked to Omar before that too. And he said, oh yeah, I totally understand. You gotta check this out on your own. But trust me when I say that I'm not doing anything funny. So there was that, which you may or may not have known, John, but anyway, I asked you to Wireshark this thing and you found something interesting, a shortcoming, if you will, in Wireshark.
And I don't know why it happened, Dave. So for those that don't know, Wireshark is, I guess we could call it a protocol analyzer or a packet sniffer.
Sure.
So what Wireshark does is it lets you monitor network traffic. Now, I'm almost certain, Dave, now it could have been on a different platform. And the thing is, Wireshark will let you see the traffic that is on the computer that it's running on, most certainly. But then in a lot of cases, you can also see traffic depending on your environment and your network adapter and a bunch of other things, you may be able to see traffic that is being exchanged between other people on the network that you're connected to, whether it be wired or wireless. And I'm almost certain, Dave, the last time, now I've made a lot of changes to my network setup since the last time I tried to do this. I think it may be because I have a newer airport, or it could be because I have now a monoprice gigabit switch in here, or something else.
Okay.
But anyway, so I was running Wireshark and I was trying to monitor the traffic. So, you know, of course I went on, you know, both my iPad and my iPhone, you know, looked at the IP address and then I started looking through the packet capture in Wireshark to see the IP address of either of my iDevices. And they only showed up very rarely for what's called broadcast traffic, which is traffic that gets sent to everybody on the network. But I wasn't seeing the traffic from the browser that you found, Dave. I'm like, well, this isn't right. This is no good, man.
Right.
Because I want to make sure that they're not doing anything funky, because there was a case where, as we mentioned, someone had a version of Tor that was doing things other than Tor.
Right.
And that's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I'm like, what do I do? And then I think you and I bounced it back and forth. And actually, we found a message on one of the Wireshark support boards. As it turns out, I think it was from the person that wrote the program, saying, hey, guys, why don't you come and check this out? What do I mean by this, Dave? I don't know if I'm going to get the name right here.
You can say the name, though. It's called Dabuki.
Dabuki. Dabuki. So, yeah, so somebody posted a message saying, hey, if you want to monitor traffic on the network and see, you know, especially wireless traffic from other devices, why don't you try running this thing called Dabuki? I'm like, oh, cool. So I decided to check it out. You can download a trial version. And sure enough, it has a mode where you can actually, so first it has a mode where it'll scan, probably doing a broadcast ping or something like that. It'll show you all of the IP addresses of all the devices on the network that you're connected to.
Sure.
Oh, that's cool. But then the cool part, Dave, and then I got in touch with the author who, told us some of the trickery here, is you can actually pick any one of the IP addresses and then say, oh, okay, I want to see all the traffic
coming to and from this IP address.
And John didn't mean to sound evil. That's still just core audio in Mavericks when that happens. So keep going, John. It's fun. We like it. It's good. It happens by surprise. It's awesome. I love it.
And so I got in touch with the author and I wrote him a thing. And the thing is, I know Dave again, he explained a lot of things that I already knew about networks as far as, you know, being a switch and you're not supposed to see broadcast. And
yeah, but
and
I'm going to stop you right there. I'm glad you understand stop those, me. But our listeners don't. So what, or may not, I don't mean I make no assumptions about the knowledge level, which is why I want to explain this. What the problem with Wireshark is that it shows you all the traffic that your network device sees. And when I mean your network device, I mean either your airport connection or your Ethernet connection. And that's the computer that it's running on. Every bit of information that passes across that network connection, it will show you. However, there's a lot of data on your network that doesn't pass across each computer's internet connection or each computer's network connection. And that's just in the interest of efficiency. There's security reasons too, but really it was designed with efficiency. You don't need every computer getting every bit of data that's sent to any other computer on the network. In fact, it's better if you don't. It's better if each computer only sees the data that it needs to send or receive. So switches work that way. When you plug Ethernet devices into switches, things get decided and it says, okay, you're only going to get the traffic meant for you. And that's that. And wireless networks, for obvious efficiency reasons, also do the same thing. They don't just barf all the traffic for every device on the network off to you and vice versa. All the traffic from each wireless device doesn't just get barfed to everybody. And that was the problem with Wireshark. Your iOS device is a wireless device. So it's very, you know, compartmentalized on the traffic. It's very segmented. And your Mac had no reason to see what your iOS device was doing communicating out on the internet. That would be inefficient if your network ran that way. So it was doing everything it was supposed to and not at all what you wanted. But Dabuki, as you said, finds a way around that. It's actually pretty creative.
Well, the way he gets around it is something that is deep within the bowels of TCP/IP. And you will see this if you run Wireshark or any packet scanner. And it's a method called ARP, or Address Resolution Protocol. And what happens is that network equipment will often send out a message saying, yeah, hi, who owns this IP address or this hardware address? Let me know so I can do the right thing.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, it's neither good nor evil, but you can use an ARP packet to redirect traffic where I don't know if I want to say it shouldn't go, but you may be able to redirect the traffic to other places that you'd like it to go. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Essentially, what you can do is have one computer masquerade as other computers simultaneously. So what this Dabuki does is it allows you to say, hey, all the traffic that's destined for that iPad over there, you go ahead and send it there because, of course, that's where it's supposed to go. But also send it to me. And that was the trick that we were missing with Wireshark. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure we could have done it from the terminal, but Dabuki makes it way easier to do this.
Well, yeah. If we knew how to craft if we crafted the appropriate ARP packet,
that's right.
That would happen as well. Dabuki does that for you. And actually, I think he informed me is that once you do put Dabuki in this mode, then if you do run Wireshark, you will see Wireshark will also see
right.
the traffic of others.
That totally makes sense. Yeah.
So very clever way of letting you see what you want.
Right. And they do. I think it is important to state that, you know, our initial path down this this rabbit hole was all for all with good intentions. Right. But a lot of the things that we wound up doing here, especially this one where we were, you know, essentially hijacking or sniffing traffic intended for only for another device, is something that certainly could be used for nefarious purposes too. We have yet to use it for those purposes. And I don't encourage you to use it for those purposes. You use it for whatever you need to use it for. And we leave it at that. But thus far, I at least I can say I haven't used it for any nefarious purposes, John. And we'll leave it at that. Right. But it did work. And when you tested it with this Red Onion browser, the initial, I mean, this took what I thought was going to be a 5-minute thing for you. This took, you know, us both like 2 weeks of research and actually quite a bit of fun. But when you finally did test it against Red Onion, what did you find?
Well, everything that I saw in the packet exchange, none of it was traffic that surprised me. It all appeared to be traffic that was a Tor connection being established.
Yeah.
That I didn't see it going anywhere other than, because I also did this actually when I ran Tor, you know, the Tor browser on my Mac. In that case, what I did is actually disabled some things in a little snitch, and I watched little snitch kind of looking over my shoulder saying, oh, you're establishing a Tor section. Okay, well, all right, it's going from here to here, you know, and here's the port and here's the IP address. And I'm like, so I compared the two and they looked similar. So I have a high confidence level that Red Onion is in fact doing what it claims to.
So I did the same thing. Once you hipped me to Dabuki here, I ran the same test, because once you have Dabuki, it's so easy to do this. And it's actually really handy to do it to an iOS device, because they don't tend to send a lot of extra traffic. Occasionally you see push notifications coming through and back and forth, which is cool. But yeah, just like you, John, I found that, you know, once I got that Tor connection, it didn't matter what websites I tried to connect to with that browser. I never saw anything new get created. There was just that one connection to the Tor network, and that was it. And then I figured, well, I had my son next to me, so I was showing him this. I'm like, see, when we go to Safari and browse, you get all this data that shows up here. When we go to this Tor thing, nothing. And I said, well, let's test it with the VPNs that we have set up, because not only do I have a VPN set up here at the house, I've got one set up at my dad's house and other places. And I said, so let's connect to granddad's house, you know, to my son. And then once we connect there, let's see if Safari, if traffic on Safari shows anything. And it shows nothing. All you see is the one VPN connection and nothing else. No DNS lookups, zilch. And so it was like, great. This is, you know, these tunnels work like they're supposed to, which was cool to see. And then, John, I had an interesting thing happen about 3 days later. My son came home from school and I had said, let's set you up with the VPN on your iPhone. That way, if you ever need to do anything, you know, if you're connecting, if you're in like a coffee shop or, you know, anything like that on a public network, you can use this. And he said, is it okay if I use it a lot? And I said, sure, it doesn't matter. We don't have Comcast currently doesn't have any bandwidth limits here at the house. So sure, use it for whatever you want. I said, I'll let you know if that ever changes. This is great. 3 or 4 days later, he comes home from school. He says, hey, you know, that VPN thing we set up, it works great. I said, oh, that's good. I'm glad to hear. He says, yeah, the school had blocked traffic to and from Instagram years ago. He said, but, you know, it hit me the other day. I've got this VPN. They have no idea. There's, you know, it's going to tunnel to the house and then the house gets to Instagram. Right. And he said, so I turned it on and sure enough, Instagram came right up. Like, that's awesome. I guess. So, you know, so there you go. That's
well, Dave, I think he essentially in a roundabout way did what we suggested in 500, which was to circumvent part of the system that the school had in place.
That's right.
To prevent access to Instagram by using a VPN.
Yeah.
Which I think was also, well, I don't know how the school blocks that, if they use OpenDNS or something like
that. No, it's not a DNS thing, because I have tried it.
Oh, it's not.
Okay. I haven't tried Instagram at the school, but there are, I use the VPN at the school all the time because I can't get to my email the right way. And there's all this other stuff. So I just turn on a VPN. I don't care about it. But I did try doing like Google's DNS and it did not allow me to bypass. So it's more, there's more to it than that. Yeah.
Why would they block Instagram? I mean, how are the kids going to send pictures of their food to each other? I mean, come on.
I don't know. I know. I know.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe they want to, you know, so then what they've convinced the kids to do is not use the Wi-Fi network at school and just use the, you know, their cell data, which is like, you know, I feel like we should, as the parents, we should go to the school and say, hey, what's going on here? Why are, you know, if we're going to pay, if we, the parents of all the kids at the school, are going to pay for the bandwidth for them to access Instagram, I'd rather pay for that through the Wi-Fi network at the school, because that's just our tax dollars. It doesn't, you know, it's all the same, as opposed to paying for the wireless bandwidth, which is far more expensive per megabyte. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there you go. But it was fun. I'm glad we found Dabuki and all of this. So there you go.
Now, Melissa brings up a good question.
Make sure everybody knows. What are you talking about?
This is violating some sort of policy.
Who says this, John?
Well, in our chat room, Dave, here. How do you get our chat room, you may ask? And I would say that while we're having the show here, if you go to MacGeekGab.com/stream, you can go to our live audio and also text chat.
There you go.
But one of our esteemed members in the chat room here was questioning whether by accessing the VPN, is that violating some sort of policy at the school? And, you know, probably it may be. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. But it's a policy that I would happily support either a revision or certainly a review of it. If in fact, that does violate it. Because, again, the kids are accessing it anyway. I'd rather we just do it through the, you know, through the school's network. So,
well, you told me that even early on, I guess in the earlier grades, I think they would prohibit kids from having cell phones or using cell phones.
That was a long time ago.
Oh, okay. They got over that.
Oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah. 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 Things have changed in the last 10 years.
You told me your daughter did the, kind of the hand, the this is not the phone you're looking for.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. All right. You know, our first sponsor for the show that I mentioned is Gazelle at gazelle.com. And one of the best things, they just make it so, they're awesome. Gazelle is, for so many reasons. The whole purpose of what they do is to make it super easy to take a device that you have and no longer use or don't plan on using anymore and turn it into cash. That's what they do. You visit their website, and they've got an awesome website. It works on iOS really well. I've gone through the entire process on iOS, and not just for the reasons of being able to talk about it on the show. I've actually sold things through their iPhone interface, like while I'm on wireless network, right? Not a wireless network, while I'm on, you know, 4G or whatever. It's super efficient, super clean. You just go to the website before you even give them your name or address or anything. You tell them what you have. And you just select, you say, okay, I've got a, you know, an iPhone 5 and I want to sell it. And they say, okay, great. What carrier, how big, what condition is it in? I think those are the questions. Oh, and was it engraved? I think it's worth about $4 less if it was engraved, if memory serves me. And then you just go through the process and they ask you these questions and they give you a price. They say, okay, this is what we'll give you for it. If everything you say is true and that's actually the phone you have, great. This is what we'll give you for it. And if you say no, then you walk away and they don't even know who you were. If you say yes, then they say, okay, great. Either log into your account if you've got one, or give us your name, your address, your email. We'll send you a box, no charge to you. They send you the box. You put your device in the box. You wipe it out first. They give you all the instructions, including a shipping label and tape to tape the box back up. You ship the box back to them. They open the box. They say, hey, this is what Dave said he was going to send us. Awesome. Send him his payment. If you want it via PayPal, they'll send you PayPal. If you want a check, they'll send you a check. If you want an Amazon gift card, they'll actually, I think they throw in an extra 5% if you do it that way. So it's awesome. And they've been doing it for a long time. It's funny, you know, when with this show, John, we hear about people's problems, right? It's what we do. It's the questions that we get, typically people with problems. And that holds true when people have issues with any kind of service provider out there, sponsor or not. We have never gotten an email about Gazelle that is not just like glowing with praise. These guys are awesome. Like I said, I've had a handful of experiences with them. I don't have that much stuff to sell to them, so I haven't had the experience of doing it hundreds of times, but you all have. And every email we get is about how awesome they were and how they went above and beyond for customer service and all of that. So I highly recommend it. Check them out. Gazelle.com through the process of checking out when you actually do, you know, give them your name and all that. They'll ask you where you heard about it from. Select Mac Geek Gab from the list. It's right there. They make it super easy, and it lets them know that that you folks are listening. So we appreciate it. Thanks, Gazelle. Gazelle.com. All right, John. Let's. Michael has an interesting one that I've been eager to. To do here, but I can't find it. Are you still with me, John? Did I lose you?
No, I'm with you.
Okay.
Yeah, the sound.
Yeah, Michael says, here is the sound, and we're going to play you the sound, but I'm going to tell you about it first. Here's the sound that's coming out of my MacBook Air that I recorded with my iPhone. The sound lasts for about 4 minutes, then it stops, and my internet connection goes away. I can reboot, and after about 3 reboots, I get a reboot where without the sound, and everything works fine. Have you ever heard this type of sound before? Any guesses? I have no idea what this sound is, John. And I don't think any... I posted this to our Google Plus page. I posted it to Twitter. Nobody has an idea.
It sounds very close to, but not quite, Dave. So it's once I heard it, I was like, you know I've heard that here before. And I think it's close to, but not exactly the find my iPhone or find my iDevice.
Oh, I wonder if it's find my Mac. And it does
find
that.
Find my Mac. It didn't sound exact. Now, it could be it got a little distorted in recording it. That's
sure.
What it sounded like to me. Now, why it would be playing without you getting an additional alert, because typically when you get that sound on your Mac, so if you tell your Mac or if you go to find my iPhone or find my Mac, you know, the control center through a web page, and you say tell the device to make a sound, in addition to a sound you typically get something else like a dialogue.
Yeah,
right? You don't just hear the sound. So if he's just hearing the sound and not getting a dialogue.
Yeah, we're getting a bunch of people in the chat room, Brian and Melissa, both. In fact, they were both guests on 500, saying that this is without question, find my Mac. And it makes sense, right? Because after it sends its pings out for however many minutes, it shuts down the internet connection. So there you go. Now, somebody else is saying, is it Prey at preyproject.com? I've never heard of Prey Project, but it is a anti-theft thing, kind of like Find My Mac or Find My iPhone. They say it works on iOS. I'd be curious to see how that works, but we'll put a link in the show notes anyway, because it's coming from a trusted source. I'm not sure. I suppose what you'd want to do is dig around in your system preferences for iCloud there and see if in fact Find My Mac is enabled. And I would change my password on iCloud as quickly as possible there, Michael, because if you did not initiate this Find My Mac thing, and you may have like weeks ago, right? But if you didn't initiate it, then someone else did. And that's not a good thing. So,
yeah, so hold on a sec here.
Yeah. And Brian in the chat room says he just, there you go.
Well, that's my Mac, but again, I'm doing it while I'm already logged into it and all that. So,
okay.
But I'm getting a dialogue saying, find my Mac alert. And I have to click okay, saying go away. But
now I think the advice is, certainly change your password without question. And then turn find my Mac off. I would reboot the Mac, turn it back on, reboot the Mac and take it from there. There you go. All right. Well, that's interesting. Thanks everybody in the chat room. And hopefully I certainly learned something. I don't know why I didn't even think of that. I'm glad you did, John. That's awesome. 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 All right. You want to take us to Louis, John?
Louis. All right. Yeah, years, I think it's Louis. So,
yeah, it is Louis. He's from Montreal.
All right. So we've been having a back and forth with Louis here. So first he had a problem with establishing a VPN connection. And I think actually the solution was delete the VPN entry and enter all the data again. And I think that turned out to fix his problem, which is kind of bizarre.
Must That's true.
Or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It could have been. Because we looked at all his settings and it was like, dude, it looks like everything is, you know, everything is correct. You know, yep. the IP address, the user, and it was.
Yeah.
So, all right. But he says, now that I've managed
to run a working VPN server for my Synology
with your help, I would like to connect to a Mac Mini on my home network through my laptop on the road. I have no idea if this is a monumental task or a simple type of thing. Can you help me out with this? I've set up my Synology to run a VPN server with the following settings, and we're not going to go into details because he set it all up properly.
Sure.
It's pretty straightforward on the Synology, as it is, well, give you a
OS X server
here in a moment. Right, because actually I had someone, so a little tangent, but someone on one of my internet pals said, how can I set up a VPN server? And I'm like, well, here's a pointer. And I pointed him to the OS X server page. And he's like, oh, I didn't realize OS X server had a VPN. It's like, yes, it does. So back to Louis here. So I have managed to connect my laptop to my VPN server on Synology via PPTP. I see that it is connected correctly, no error messages, but when I run Finder on my laptop, I don't see my Mac Mini at home. Is it because the IP addresses handed up by my VPN server are not in the same range as my router? My router and home network is operating in the 192.168 range, or is it a port forwarding issue? If you could just steer me in the right direction, that would be great. And here's the truth, Dave. As we all here's what's happening. So I wrote back and I said, I assume what you mean. I'll tell you now. Right now, I assume what you mean is that you are not seeing your computer or other devices in the shared section of the Finder sidebar.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Which is true, right? It doesn't show up when you connect via a VPN, as opposed to back to my Mac, which is a little bit different. But when you connect via a VPN, that
right.
you don't see those machines appear magically via Bonjour in your sidebar.
Right. Now there's one article here that you have an article which may have solved this problem. I think it does touch on this, Dave, but it's an article, OS X Mavericks, if you can't find the computer you want to connect to. So that could have solved this problem. Or I think it does touch on this as well. So, you know, we'll link to that article.
Sure.
But then I did a little more digging, and yeah, like you, Dave, I believe we talked about this before, but I believe the issue is that the Bonjour service that is used to advertise items so they appear in the sidebar doesn't normally transverse a VPN. In addition, I think it doesn't transverse routers and other things. So if it goes through too many jumps,
yes.
Bonjour doesn't work.
Yep.
It's fine if you're on your own local network, but if you're jumping through other hoops, then yeah, you're probably not going to see things there. Which led him to believe he wasn't set up right, but that was not the case. Now, I did find also another article, which I think he can dig in. So in some VPN configurations, you can set it up so that it will allow you. And this is an article I found that actually talks about how you can do this with OpenVPN to allow it to see Bonjour. Isn't that cool? And I think a similar strategy could be used. But what he should be able to do, so this gets to be a little annoying because Bonjour is handy, certainly. What he should be able to do, though, Dave, is connect if he knows the IP address. And this is where you got to know a little mojo here, which we're going to share with you. And it's how do you address, for example, a file server. So say you want to get to a file server, like an AFP, Apple File Protocol, mm-hmm. right? Something like that. Say you want to get to a server on your network once you're connected via VPN that's running AFP, doing the Apple file sharing. Well, there's two ways you could do it, Dave. So actually one, which is kind of handy, you could do it through Safari and you type it in like a normal URL, but instead of typing HTTP, you type AFP:// Now, the other place you could do this is you could do it in the Finder. So you could go to the Go menu, then the Connect menu, and it's going to ask you for the same thing. And you just type the same thing, AFP:// and then the IP address. And at that point, it'll make the connection. And he'll be prompted for the username and password, and everything's great.
I would offer that will work, no question about it.
Yeah,
and it's a great way to do it, and it unfortunately is still kind of the default in that it's what my fingers know to do. But
right.
in Mavericks, of course, we have eschewed AFP when we can run SMB2. Because SMB2 is way faster and way more efficient than AFP. And in fact, if you have two Mavericks machines, and there's not something wonky going on with your network, SMB2 is what they will use to connect to each other for file sharing. So my advice, especially over a WAN, the internet, you know, a wide area network, would be to use SMB because I think it's more efficient for that type of stuff. So instead of typing AFP:// in the Go menu, you type SMB:// and there you go. So that's all. But what you described works, and I do it all the time, and then I think, oh, I should have done it with SMB, but I don't. But I should. So there you go.
But we're gonna peel the onion here, Dave, because I wrote that and then got a reply saying thank you.
You're welcome. No.
Yeah. No problem. And then to continue, I realized I was not very clear in my email. Just to clarify, yes, I don't see Mac Mini in the shared section. So I got that right. But then he said, my ultimate goal is to share the screen with my Mac Mini via the VPN. I'm planning to run Mail app with spam.
That's all. It doesn't matter what he's doing. He just wants to share the screen.
So he
That's
didn't right. want to do a file server connection, which is one thing that you could certainly do with the Bunch. Or he wanted to do a screen share. Now, this leads to the question, Dave, what is the special sauce that you need to make? And you kind of hinted at this, is that there's many different URL schemes to connect to things.
That's
so
right.
If you want to connect to do a screen share, the secret sauce here is you type VNC:// and the IP address of the machine. What that'll do is launch the screen sharing application. And to peel the onion yet another layer, Dave, this is actually an application that you normally cannot run because it's not in the applications folder. Where is it, you may ask? And I'm going to tell you, it's in system library core services. But again, if you type VNC, it will launch the screen sharing app, which is the same thing that happens if you try to connect to a machine on Bonjour. And that did it for him. And he said, thanks. So
that's awesome.
That's it. It was a great adventure because I actually had verified this, you know, via, you know, my various side devices and VPNs. And actually I've been setting up. So I actually have now an open VPN server and a PPTP VPN both set up on my Synology.
And we're going to get a lot of listeners. And I know this, and you know it too, telling us that point to point tunneling protocol PPTP is not nearly as secure as we would all like to think. And that we really should be using something else and not at all doing that. But by golly, it's so darned easy to set that up that I fall for that trap all the time.
Well, the only thing I'd say is that you and I have tussled over this in the past, is that a VPN
doesn't guarantee security.
To me, it almost always implies it. But the thing is, when I set up these connections, most of the clients that I use will say, okay, well, give me the IP address, the username, the password. And by the way, what crypto level would you like to use? Now, you could certainly say none, or you could say 40-bit or 128-bit. I think that's what you're getting at, is that a VPN doesn't necessarily imply good security, but I guess what I'm saying is that you can certainly force it, depending on what you're using.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. I thought even if you turned on security, the authentication of it is what's insecure, right? That the handshake that it does to exchange and the methods by which it exchanges your username and password are using some ancient and known to be crackable security. Now, whatever it uses once you're connected may or may not be any better than that. But I think that is it CHAP, CHAP that they usually use with PPTP? We're getting really geeky now. But I think that's where the issue is that your password is like super.
The initial password exchange. Now, actually, you bring up a good point because I did this as well. So I was verifying this.
So somebody with Dabuki, right, could see that traffic and then potentially, then hack at that. So
you're correct in that. Yeah. So I actually did this as well. So if you're using OS X to connect to a VPN, what you can do is when you're in the network pref pane, you can create a VPN connector, right?
Right.
And one of the things that it does, to get to your point, Dave, just to lead people to the right place to go. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, so what it'll ask for is server address, account name, encryption, as I said. And so like for here, the one that I defined for PBTP, it says, you know, 128 bit or 40 bit, and you probably want 128. But then there's a button that says authentication settings. And this is where this is getting to your point. And it says, oh, well, would you like to use a password? And I think that's probably the weakest form. Then it has a whole bunch of other things, which you and I should actually look into. But then lists four other methods for authenticating: RSA Secure ID, which is one of these little.
But I don't think you can do RSA Secure ID with PPTP, right? I don't think that's an option. You can do that with L2TP.
I am seeing it in front of me right now. I have a PPTP VPN connector defined in my network.
Okay.
Pane.
Yep.
And when I click on authentication settings, I see password.
Oh, yeah.
RSA Secure ID, certificate, and we've talked about those, Kerberos, and crypto card, which I believe is a hardware device.
Yep.
So I believe password is probably the weakest of the five. If you can use any of the others, those would be better. But no, I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
No, it's good to warn people about that. I think that initial exchange is the Achilles heel of the whole
point-to-point tunneling protocol. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. All right, fun. All right, let's see what Daniel has to say here. Maybe we have an answer for him.
Hey, John and Dave, this is Daniel. Listen regularly to the podcast, get a great deal out of it. Thanks very much. So I thought I might ask you if you could help me with some strange issue I have. iPhone 5, running version 7.1. I have an iCloud account on it only for mail, contact calendars. I deleted the mail and reset it, but the issue remains. And it is this: when I do a general search, I'll pull down on the home screen, do a search, I end up at times, depending on the letters, with a top hit, which appears to be, it behaves like a template for an email. I mean, it has a person to whom it's addressed, and the subject
already saved in it.
And it comes out, it's the top hit, depending on the wording, and the wording would be the subject or the name of the person that's being sent to. And I don't always type that subject, but if I type the combination of the letters, then it will come up as a top hit. If I tap on it, it's like it's automatically created an email to this person with that subject in the line that is the search result. And it's really weird. And I don't know where that resides on the phone, why it's sitting there. Again, I deleted the email account, turned off the mail syncing, not the whole account, turned off the mail syncing, turned it back on, did a search again, and there it is. Now, if I do that same search on the iPad, I don't believe it's there. Sorry. Let me just do a quick check there.
Well, we'll assume it wasn't there. Unfortunately, there's no Apple prescribed way of cleaning errant cache files off of your iOS device other than wiping it clean and either restoring from a backup, which in this case, I think actually would work because the backups don't tend to store all that cache file stuff. It'll rebuild it, which is what you want. Or if that doesn't work, then wipe the device and don't restore from a backup. But there's no middle ground. It's not like a Mac where we can dig in easily and fix this stuff. However, sometimes software out there can help. And one of those pieces of software, and I don't know if that this is going to help you or not, Daniel, is called Phone Clean. And one of the things it does is it cleans out what shows up in iTunes as all of that yellow other data is one of the things it does. It does quite a few things, but that's one of them. And a lot of that other data is cache files and things like that. There's other stuff in there too, but those cache files are there, and forcing your iPhone to rebuild them can sometimes solve these pesky problems that otherwise would take, you know, a shotgun approach. So I definitely shoot a backup of your iPhone before you mess with this. I've never had it cause me any trouble, but I always shoot a backup anyway. But then try running Phone Clean. If you have a backup, it can't hurt. So I'll leave it at that, other than, of course, time and restoring from the backup. But any thoughts on this, John?
No.
Nothing? None at all?
No.
Okay.
It befuddles me.
It is one of those befuddling things. It's a frustration with iOS. I get it, but it doesn't mean I like it. So, all right. Well, we will move on to Robert then, John. Why don't you, you've got some thoughts on that. Why don't you take us there?
Oh, boy. Yeah, and I got some thoughts for Robert. I mean, this is Robert, the graphics guy.
All right.
So he claims. I'll believe him on that one. So Robert writes, when I try to install this app, I get blocked. Any idea why? And he actually attached an installer to an email, which normally you would be insane to launch. But since this is someone that I know, Robert, we've met in the past and we're Facebook pals and all that, I trusted that he wasn't trying to ruin my day. But yeah, I took it. So I took and actually I wasn't able to duplicate the behavior. So then I had to kind of figure out what exactly did Robert mean by saying he gets blocked. And it's an app that is supposed to allow importing images into GoDaddy's
email composer.
And he needs to do this for a client because he's the graphics guy. And he said he called GoDaddy support and they seem useless. And I guess in this case, I would have to kind of agree, Dave, because I figured it out.
Yeah, he's not alone, though. There's lots of apps where this happens, where you try to install and nothing. Right. It says,
right.
So can't do it. You this app is off limits and there's no, hey, I'm okay to bypass option. It's just okay. And that's it. That's all you get.
Well, so first I had to decipher what Robert was saying. So if by blocked, he meant he got a dialogue saying can't be open because it is from an unidentified developer, which I believe was the case. And I think this was confirmed. Yeah. That's because that's the way that Robert has Gatekeeper configured. What is Gatekeeper?
And it's also the way Gatekeeper is configured by default on every installation.
Right. So Gatekeeper is a feature of OS X that prevents you from installing bad software. And there are three levels. One is ultra paranoid. One is kind of a go-between. And one is I don't care. And it's set up for the go-between, which is if something is not signed. That was my response. So one, we have, and I'll put in our chat room here. So Apple has an article about this and we will link to it. But the thing was, he was getting the response that you get when an app is not signed. Now, it's unfortunate because you would think somebody like GoDaddy, who I assume has a couple of bucks here and there, would sign their application or their installer, but they chose not to.
It actually,
shame on them.
To my knowledge, it requires no money whatsoever to sign your apps in order to have them for sale.
Well,
in
you
Apple's
gotta get a cert and you gotta run a process or pursue, but it takes time,
a little bit of time.
Is money, right?
Yeah, but we're talking probably 10 minutes to right. to do this, right? It and you register your certificate with Apple and that's it. You do not have to pay for a Mac developer account to do this. You have to pay for a Mac developer account if you want your app included in the store. But otherwise, you can just do this for free. So it really isn't a big deal. So go ahead.
Right. So to me, it's either shame on GoDaddy for not doing this or shame on whoever they hired to write this app for not signing the app. Because come on, you're right. Just making life difficult for people like Robert.
Yeah, exactly.
But we're going to make life easy for Robert because there's a way to get around this for apps that say, yo, I'm not signed. What you do, and this is a little way to get around this, is you control click on the app in question that gives you this error, and then you say open in the contextual menu. What will then happen is you will be given another warning, but you will be given an option to say open again. So if you say open, that will then launch the installer.
Yeah, you right click on the app and choose open, and then you'll get a similar but not the same dialogue, right?
Right.
And this dialogue now has the option to bypass by clicking open, and it says, hey, you got to know what you're doing. So it's very similar. It used to be that double clicking something was exactly the same as control clicking it and choosing open. In this instance, it is not exactly the same. And the control clicking or right clicking of an installer or an application will allow you to bypass Gatekeeper. So it's a slight nuance.
I like it because if you're geeky enough or you're someone that listens to our podcast.
Sure.
And I say "our" because it's not mine. It's not yours, David. It belongs to all of us. So if you know enough to know this secret handshake, then it's probably okay for you to take this, you know, circumvent this mechanism.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, I agree. It's the right way to handle this, because if there was just simply if double clicking on it brought up a dialogue that said, "Are you sure you want to launch this?" Everybody would say yes, because it's how it works. But if you have to sort of intentionally go out of your way to make that happen, and the nice part is if it's an application that you're going to run over and over again, this only happens on the first launch. Once you have successfully launched it by bypassing this, then after that, you could put it in your dock and click it and it'll launch automatically. There's no problem at all. So it's just the first time that you need to do this hokey pokey. And then right, your Mac remembers.
Because my recollection is that, and I think they've gotten better, but at least under, like, you know, OS's like Windows XP, they would come up and say, "Hey, this isn't signed. You want to ignore this warning?" And yeah, like you said, David would say, "Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'll ignore it." Which most people would take the path of least resistance. Here, they offer a bit of resistance.
Right.
And if you know how to get around it, then
it's fine.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
So I had I was showing somebody something that I keep in Google Docs, and I actually keep a lot of, you and I actually keep some stuff in Google Docs, John. We have a Mac Geek Gab shared folder, and we put all kinds of things in there, mostly our agendas that we pass, that we edit collaboratively. And it's great. Google Docs is awesome for that kind of thing, because it doesn't matter what computer you're on. In fact, now you don't have to do it, on the web, on iOS, there's specific apps for Google Documents and Google Spreadsheets, and it's awesome. And they're all free. But once you have a lot of stuff in Google Docs, especially if you have multiple folders that you share with people, it can be a little bit pedantic to launch up, you know, I call it Google Docs because that's what it used to be called. It's Google Drive. So you go to drive.google.com in your browser and you sort of navigate to wherever you want to get. And, you know, if you've got folders within folders, you're navigating three levels down just to get to this file that you open every single day. Well, what Google Docs lets you do is star any file you want. And these are only starred for you. So the files that I star, even if they happen to be files that you and I share, John, they do not show up as starred for you. It's only for me, and it's always for me until I unstar that particular file. And then what you can do when you launch Google Drive, instead of digging through your folders, you just click starred on the left. And now it's going to show you all your starred files, and you can either sort by most recently modified or by name or what have you. And so that gets way more efficient. Even more efficient than that is this. And here's my trick. Go to drive.google.com. Click on starred on the left, the word starred, and it's going to show you your list of starred things. Save that URL to your bookmarks bar. So now you have, and I just saved it as GD for Google Drive. So now I go and I click GD in any browser, because of course I have my bookmark synced amongst all my devices, and boom, I'm right there at all my starred stuff. It's awesome. Way more efficient. And it makes the process of sharing multiple folders and all that stuff with people, it's completely seamless to me, because they're all the documents that I need to work on are in my starred folder. And if I need something that's not, well, then I go dig. And maybe I'll star that if it's something I'm going to be working on regularly. So there's my tip for you with Google Drive. So hopefully that comes in handy to several of you out there. I want to talk about our second sponsor for this show, and that is the folks at Drobo. Drobo.com. And we've talked about this before, but the original CEO, the original leadership team is actually back at Drobo. They went off, they formed a company called Connected Data, which made a product called the Transporter. They're now back at Drobo, and the current crop of products out from them is theirs. And this stuff is, they're doing a really, really good job. They've got the Drobo 5D, which is their direct connect. It's a 5-bay device. Now what Drobo did and what they really kind of pioneered, especially in terms of the ease of use department a long time ago, is the idea of having a box into which you put all your extra SATA drives, and they don't have to be extra drives, but you put in up to 5 SATA drives, and it will magically manage the space amongst all those drives, present it to you as one volume if you like. With the direct connected one, you can sort of manage it in a couple of different ways, but makes sense to do it as one volume. And then and the drives can be of different sizes. So, and if you need to expand, well, that's where it gets really fun. You take out the smallest drive and replace it with something larger, and suddenly you now have more storage space to use. Same volume. You didn't have to delete your data. You didn't have to do anything magic. You just do it. And the 5D is a Thunderbolt device. And of course, when you've got multiple drives going, assuming those drives are all of at least moderate speed, they don't even have to be that fast because you've got, you know, so many of them in there. You can really get some killer performance out of this thing. You can also add an SSD accelerator card, an mSATA SSD accelerator card to the 5D to make it go even faster, because then it's caching the data that you're writing to it, so it can do the writes kind of asynchronously without the risk of losing data, because it's an SSD. So, you know, you're good to go there. And the 5-bay 5D uses 3.5-inch SATA drives, and it really is easy. You just slide them in. If you want a network attached version that's also super simple to use, that's what the 5N is for. Same concept, except instead of a Thunderbolt port, it's got a network port. And you connect it up. You can have multiple machines connect to it. You can actually set up Time Machine volumes on it for your various computers. And they're really doing a great job with all the new stuff they're doing over there at Drobo. So I highly, highly recommend you check them out. And I'm happy to have them on board as a sponsor. Their direct connected stuff is some of the easiest stuff I've ever used. We see a lot of, different, I'll use the term RAID, even though this isn't really RAID. Drobo calls it Beyond RAID. We see a lot of this stuff here. There's nothing direct connected that's as simple to use as what Drobo's doing, especially when it comes time to, you know, just in expand your storage, take a drive out, put a new one in, and it does it. It'll relay everything out. It might take a day depending on how much data you have on there and how much data you're moving around, but it takes care of it. And that's how it's supposed to be. So check them out. Drobo.com is the place to check them out, and let them know we sent you. Drobo.com. All right, John, you want to take us to Brent?
First though, Dave, you mentioned being back. Do you know who else is back, Dave?
Jack is back.
Ah, good. Are you recording this?
Yeah. We've been watching 24 with the kids. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Yeah. So for those of you who haven't watched it, awesome, I think, in my opinion. And I think the new one, so far I'm interested.
Yeah. Live Another Day, right?
It has the whole edge of your seat kind of multiple time frame, kind of cool, cool stuff going on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fun.
So, hi, Jack and Chloe. All right. So who do we have here? You said Brent. You know, you'd expect me to have that in front of me. And I do, Dave.
Awesome.
So Brent writes, I currently have a 27-inch iMac with a 256 gig SSD and a separate, not Fusion drive, 2 terabyte hard drive. Due to an AppleCare replacement, I will be getting a brand new 27-inch iMac with a 3 terabyte Fusion drive. My question is, my iTunes media folder, which is located on the spindle. No, sorry. Okay. So his iTunes library is located on an external 2 terabyte hard drive. I have multiple backups of that through Time Machine, Backblaze cloud backup, iTunes Match bootable backup as well. What would be the easiest way when I get the new machine, which will have a 3 terabyte Fusion drive, to get my contents of the 2 terabyte Fusion drive to the new computer, or 2 terabyte drive, not Fusion, to the new computer? I think that's really the question, Dave. Yes?
Yeah, that's the question. Yeah, just how do
you and I toss this back and forth, because I unfortunately got a bit, there was a lot of red herrings in here.
Yes, yeah, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah, no, the simple answer is, I currently, or the simple, the distillation of the question
problem
is,
statement.
Yeah, there it is, the problem. Oh, it's been a long time since I've thought of that term. Is that he's got all of his data spread across multiple drives, and he wants to consolidate it, coalesce it, if you will, onto one drive and have it all just work smoothly.
Right. And I'm going to assume that the only data, so it sounds to me like the only data that is on the external 2 terabyte drive is the iTunes library. Now, there may be other data, sure, but that was not stated.
Yeah, for the sake of our discussion here, treat it that way. Right.
Right. Yep. And in which case, if the way the system is set up now is only iTunes is on the external drive, then here's what I'd do. Is first, I would go into iTunes, Preferences, Advanced, and make sure, and I believe this is the default, but make sure that Keep iTunes Media Folder Organized is checked. Because that makes sure that all the contents of the iTunes library is contained in the iTunes folder. Then at that point, once you've made sure of that, then I would make a backup.
And it but just checking that box does not make that so. It makes it so for the future and with anything you add, but not, it does not magically consolidate your library. That you have to do as a manual step after you check the box.
All right, so if the box, all right, so if it is checked, then you're cool.
You're probably
cool.
If
it's not checked, what are you saying if it's not checked?
If it's not checked.
And then check it. Do you have to say you just quit iTunes?
No, you have to, in iTunes, you have to go.
Speak to me, brother.
Yep, you have to go to the File menu, Library, Organize Library, and then check the Consolidate Files box, and then hit OK. And that's going to bring everything into your iTunes music folder. So I realize this is really confusing to talk about, especially without you seeing, by you, I mean our listeners seeing what we're talking about here. But in iTunes Preferences, when you check the box that says Keep iTunes Music Folder Organized, that's for anything you add going forward. It will copy it into the iTunes music folder, which really is, in most cases, the best way to manage it. But if you don't check that, then it lets you have your music and movies and everything in different places and with just pointers from your iTunes library to it. If you want to consolidate everything, though, you first need to check that box. Then you go into File, Library, Organize Library, and then check the Consolidate Files box and hit OK. And that, depending on how many things need to be copied, that might take 10 seconds or it might take 10 hours. But that's the process. And if it does copy things in, it copies them. So you will have two copies of these, one wherever it started life and one in your iTunes music folder. So there you go.
Thank you for the interjection.
You bet.
Because I think what I was going to mention in a moment here was touched on in what you just said, but
yep.
But it's good you brought it up early because, yeah, I don't want to lead people astray. But so once you have everything consolidated and iTunes is all organizing it, then as far as I know, just make a copy of the iTunes folder.
Yeah,
copy it over, and you should be okay on the new machine if you copy over the iTunes folder.
As long as you then go copy it in and then point iTunes on the new computer to be wherever you moved that folder in. I mean, you've got to tell it this is where my library is.
Yes.
Yeah. And then once you do that, you may still have lingering issues. I've seen this. Where when you move things around, you do all the right stuff and you put the stuff in the right spot and you tell iTunes, here's where it is. Sometimes it takes your actual library file a little nudge to get in the right direction. So you may go to play a song and it comes up and it says, I can't find this one. Can you navigate to it for me? And you do. You have to go and navigate and say, this is where this song is. And you dig into your library and artists and all that stuff. Right. And then you say, this is where the song is. Usually, though, once you do that once, it sort of says, maybe everything else is here too. And it tries to intelligently sort of inherit that for everything else. You might have to do it, you know, half a dozen times throughout the process of playing music for the first week. But after that, it should be okay.
Okay.
It's crazy.
And I think all of this is summarized and I sent this to our friend Brent, but there is a wonderful article called iTunes for Mac, Moving Your iTunes Media Folder.
Absolutely.
It touches on everything, most of the points that, that you and I have both made, Dave.
Yeah, with pictures, which for some of these steps is way better than hearing us try to describe it. Yep. So I will make sure that's in the show notes.
And I think at the end of the question, it was, you know, there was a question, should I use Migration Assistant to do this? And
I don't think
just
so.
Just moving iTunes, I would say no.
No.
I would say follow the instructions in the iTunes, in the article that we just mentioned.
Yeah.
Just talking about moving iTunes. For other stuff, Migration Assistant is, you know, I love it.
It can be awesome. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So for pulling over all your other stuff, if the Apple people aren't going to do that for you, which I don't know if they are, because it sounds like, yeah, you're getting a swap. So maybe they'll do that for you.
Right. Yeah, they may, if you bring it in. I mean, right. Yeah. If you ask them, they probably will. That's right. That's right.
All right.
All right. Let's see. I think we've got time for one more here, John. So we'll see if we can help Adam out. Adam writes, he has a tale of woe, which was resolved fairly easily thanks to a current cloned backup drive. He says in a recent episode of Adam Christensen's MacCast, he spoke about the need he had to clear the Dynamic Link Editor's library, the Dynamic Link Editor's cache, DYLD's cache. Having never done that on my MacBook Pro 2011, I poked around in Onyx and saw under the Automation tab an option to rebuild the DYLD shared cache. Feeling intrepid, I selected it and hit execute. Things went south. I cannot remember all the warning and error messages that popped up. They were coming at me faster than tween girls to Justin Bieber. But in short, they notified me that my hard drive needed to be repaired. I attempted to reboot the computer. It shut down. And when it powered back up, it stuck on a blank light gray screen. All attempts to repair the drive using Disk Utility failed. I even tried booting from a USB Mavericks install disk and using Disk Utility to repair the hard drive from there. Long story short, I formatted the drive and restored from my most recent clone, one day old, thankfully. Now my computer is back to normal and all is well. Here is where I get back to Mac Geek Gab. In show 498, in responding to Francis's question, you adeptly described hard links and how Time Machine uses them, even though they are a bit of a hack in OS X. He says, for about 2 years, I've been using hard links created by Mac Drop Any to sync about 18 gigs from my documents folder with Dropbox. Could these hard links have caused the problems with my main hard drive, just as they seem to cause problems for Time Machine? No, I don't. I think there was more going on with your hard drive than hard links. Remember, Time Machine creates thousands of these things, and that's when things start to sort of bulge at the seams. No, I think your issue was something that we as Mac users all suffer from. In fact, we as computer users all suffer from, and that is directory corruption, that we don't the symptoms of which don't necessarily present themselves when it starts. They only tend to present themselves when it's gotten really bad. And this is why, as routine maintenance, you want to do a verify disk or a repair disk in Disk Utility, you know, I'd say fairly regularly, maybe once a quarter. It's certainly, you don't need to obsess about it more than that, unless you're seeing a trend. But I think that's the issue here. And I don't think rebuilding the DYLD cache is necessarily a bad thing. In fact, it's pretty innocuous when related to your drive's directory. I think you just happened to find the straw that broke the camel's back on this one. And it's a common thing. So and I'm glad you had a backup, because that's certainly the easiest path to resolution. You may have been able to use something like Drive Genius or Disk Warrior to rebuild the directory and all of that. And listen, if you don't have a backup, that's exactly what you want to do. But really the best thing is to not get into that pickle to begin with. And so running either Disk Utilities, repair disk or verify disk, or Drive Genius or Disk Warrior. Well, Disk Warrior probably best not to run as a preventative maintenance. That's really only to solve problems. But using Drive Genius's repair disk, or again, Disk Utilities repair disk, they both do it a little bit differently. Or just simply the way I do it, John, is when I think about it, and I'll probably think about it tomorrow now because we're talking about it on the show, but I boot into single user mode. I reboot my Mac with Command and S. That gets me to a command prompt, and there is the command right above where you finish the command prompt. There's a command written above it that you can just type in. It's FSCK space dash FY space slash. And that will run file system check. Effectively the same thing Disk Utility runs. But it'll run it in single user mode so you can do repairs right there. And it's just not a bad thing to do. If you see problems there that it can't fix, that's when you need to step up your game and try something like Drive Genius or Disk Warrior. But it is the kind of thing that if you catch these problems early, then they won't get necessarily, they won't get too bad. And usually Disk Utility or FSCK can fix them. So that's my advice. I'm sorry you had to go through this. I'm really glad you had a backup. That's all I got. Yeah.
No, I'm with you. And, toss in a few things here. I like Drive Pulse from Drive Genius because it does occasional checks for you.
Oh, does it do?
It's a commercial product.
Does it do checks?
Well, Drive Genius, Drive Pulse will do occasional. So it sounds like you do not run it, Dave. Because I do on both my Mac Mini and my MacBook Pro. I run Drive Genius, Drive Pulse.
Yeah, but let me ask: is that checking just the smart status of the drive, or is that also checking the file structure?
It is checking fragmentation status. It is checking preferences.
You're right.
It is doing a volume consistency check.
Okay.
So it kind of hangs out in the background and says, "Okay, when the machine's not doing anything else really important, then I'm going to run these things." So lacking the user remembering to do this,
right?
I think it's one of the very cool features of Drive Genius is that it has this thing called Drive Pulse that will, when it has time, will check the drive here. But now I was just thinking about this, Dave, and I just want to equate this because some people may ask, why does this happen? I mean, what? And to me, it's almost like, Dave, it's almost like a card catalog at a library. And I'm going to go way, way back here. But it's almost like a card catalog in a library and associating it with what's in the library. The thing is, when you're checking, normally when utilities are checking the directory structure and all that, they're not doing a thorough, 100% thorough check because that would take forever. It would be like you going through every card in the card catalog in the library, making sure they're all in order and then making sure every book or whatever piece of media on the shelf is where it should be.
Sure.
It would take you forever to do that. So they do the best they can in the time allotted and they'll catch most things, but they will not catch some things.
Well, to extend your analogy, what they do, they don't go and check and make sure that the book that's, or the, like you said, the media that's out there is what's supposed to be out there, but they do make sure that no two cards are pointing to the same location.
Right. And that's a doubly linked file or something like that. So, yeah. So they look for obvious goofs. Yep. But again, to comprehensively look through every piece of media and every entry in the card catalog would be time prohibitive.
Well, and it would require the user. There's no way your computer knows that, you know, img1234.jpg, that the data that it has for it is what you expect it to have for it, right? I mean, it could say, yeah, this looks like JPEG data, but who knows? Maybe it's gotten so corrupted that it happens to be pointing to the wrong JPEG. It couldn't possibly know that.
Right. Now, some of you who are into this sort of thing, if you want to look up journaled file systems, that gets around some of these problems here and that, you know, there's kind of a rollback or history and all that, but but I guess the best advice, which you offered and will offer again, is have multiple backups and put your data in multiple places because any one of them could.
Yeah. Well, it is good to have backups
at a moment's notice,
but it's also important to run Disk Utility or some sort of directory integrity scan regularly. And again,
I would say that on average about once a week, Dave, I will run Disk Utility and do both. Well, permissions repair. Well, I'll do a permission. Well, I'll do a verify. Probably about once a week.
Wow. Now,
again, if Drive,
good for you.
If Drive Pulse doesn't get around to it, so that's the one reason I really recommend Drive Pulse because it does that for you.
Yeah.
But no, if I have an extra moment, I'm like, you know what? I should check my permissions. And the thing,
well, permissions are different.
There's no difference between verify and repair permissions. I just say repair permissions.
Sure.
If they're broken, fix them, please. There's no downside to doing that. And then the only downside with verifying the drive is, yeah, it wedges your system for a while, even with an SSD, I would say, or maybe not, Dave. I don't know.
On a
spindle drive, definitely. Well, they warn you. They say, hey, by the way, man, if you run this, your system will be unresponsive for a bit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I don't know if it would be unresponsive on an SSD. Yeah, for sure. But SSDs definitely would suffer from file system corruption, just like any other. I mean, it doesn't matter what the media is. It's just file system stuff. So, yeah. All right. Well, John, I think that kicks off.
You think?
Our first 500th, our first episode in the 500th. Uh-oh. What happened here? There we are.
I thought, wow. Was that the evil band?
Yeah. So you heard it. I know.
People have been telling me about the evil John Braun. Now we have the evil band.
That's right.
And Dave, I thought that the band was coming out with some new material for our next 500 episodes.
No, they don't like change,
very
John.
Disappointed.
They're not into
as
change.
Do some of us. Go figure.
That's the name of the band.
We're closing out here, Dave.
Feedback at MacGeekGab.com. If you want to send in a comment, a tip, or a cool stuff found, and I think, I don't know if it's going to be the next show, but certainly within the next couple of weeks, we've got another cool stuff found show coming to you. So send those to us, but also send us your questions and tips and any follow-ups that you have to feedback at MacGeekGab.com.
And if you didn't hear Dave, which sometimes, you know, he's kind of quiet and reserved, and you don't know what's going on there with this Dave Hamilton fellow, but feedback. At MacGeekGab.com.
That's right. I'm the moody dark one. 206 206-666-GEEK is the phone number where you can call. And John, Geek is
4335.
That's right. It is. And I don't know. What else? We got crazy things going on in the chat room here. The chat room is always at MacGeekGab.com/stream. And that's where you can find where we're going to be when we're recording the show, and also where we are when we're recording the show. And Google Plus, come visit us on Google Plus. We've got an awesome community over there.
You and Google Plus.
Oh, dude, not me and Google Plus.
I know it's awesome. Yeah,
iPad. But all of us but you and Google Plus. But here's the thing: the Google Plus iOS app is horrible.
Yes,
the interface
tried it.
Is terrible.
I put it on the iPad. It's what? I was going to say, it's actually pretty darn good.
What just happened here? See, the band just stopped.
See, they're on strike.
It's Core Audio. Freaking Core Audio.
All I got to say is I installed the Google Plus app on my recently acquired iPad.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a pretty darn good implementation. Dave, you just... The band's
what's
done.
Going on with
they're
the band here. This Core Audio and this machine are not playing nice today. I find it really confusing for me managing my own Google Plus account versus managing the MacGeekGab account and room. It there's no way to really control that like there is in a web browser. And plus, when you scroll around, things are flying at you. But the community that we have over there is fantastic. It really is awesome. So it makes it worth it. We all contribute. Everybody brings their own questions, and listeners are helping answer questions.
Yeah, I'm with you.
It's awesome.
No, I'm starting to warm up to it. Yeah. Again, the implementation on iOS, I think, was pretty good.
Yeah, well.
Because people are saying, get the G Plus app for
iOS, and I'm like, number one.
I don't need an app. Evil band.
That's, dude. It's all
Dave,
over
I think
you.
Oh, man. I think you got some homework.
Yeah, uninstall Mavericks from this machine.
I'm still running Mountain Lion on my man. I have no intent of upgrading.
I made the critical error installing Mavericks on here. All right, let's see if we can finish this show without it all falling apart again. All right, I do want to thank, regardless of whether it falls apart, I want to thank Michael Johnston for converting the show into AAC for us and adding all those chapters for you. Michael, you're awesome. If you want to see the other awesome stuff that Michael's doing, and I really encourage you to, GetAppler.com is his website. And of course, the We Have Communicators podcast is one of my favorites. So check it out. All about iOS stuff. It's fun. They do a really good job over there. He's an excellent host. I've learned a lot about hosting people listening to him, and perhaps some of that. Perhaps some of that rubbed off in the last show. Yeah, it's awesome.
Oh,
it's great.
It's not just me.
It. Yeah. All right.
The evil Ben.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, that's Michael. Thank you, Michael. Cashfly, CACHEFLY.com provides all the bandwidth to get from us to you. The podcast marketplace includes Barebone Software, of course, SmileSoftware.com, Gazelle.com, Squarespace.com with coupon code MGG, Rage Software with Everweb, and of course, the great people at iFixit and Harry's, Harry's.com. Coupon code MGG gets you $5 off. We made it to the end, I think. Of course, now would be a really funny time to have the evil guy, which might be better than what Jeremy thought of the evil guy. So I will simply share this. Don't do anything I wouldn't do. And no matter what you do, don't get caught.
Maynard.